2 Samuel chapter 21 begins for us a bit of a transition to the kings, to 1 Kings. In fact, chapter 21 through the end of 2 Samuel don't necessarily fall into any clear chronology. 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel all plays out Saul's life into David's life and Samuel's life, and it is chronologically as it unfolds, there's a timeline to it. But when we get to the end of 2 Samuel, we're just kind of given a little bit of detail back into David's life that the author felt was important, for he includes it, but not necessary of like breaking the train of thought. This is not the first book that does this. The book of Judges is famous for taking the same approach of working out a narration and then at the end kind of going back and filling in some details that are important. And so we don't know exactly when each of these chapters would place themselves, but I think you'll get a good flavor for how it all works its way out. Diving in, verse 1 of chapter 21. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years. Year after year. Famines are not a good thing when your life is dependent upon you making your food, growing your food. Famine is rough on, obviously, produce. It's rough on cattle. It is not a good thing if you're in this type of a culture, famine, and not just for 1 year, but now we've gotten into year 2 and year 3. This is quite a thing, and the people are no doubt suffering. So we're told David, as a result, inquired of the Lord. So David goes to the Lord and he says, is this famine something we should be paying attention to? Is this a judgment? What's the deal? Is this just the natural weather patterns? Or are you trying to get our attention that we've done something wrong? Is this a judgment for some type of a behavior? What's the deal, God? And the Lord answered. He answers David. He explains that the famine, he says, it is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. Going all the way back to the book of Joshua. Joshua succeeded Moses as the leader of the children of Israel. They had left Egypt. They had come to a promised land. Moses was not allowed to take them into the land. It's a whole side story. Joshua becomes the man. Joshua leads them into the promised land. Joshua goes about establishing the nation, dividing the land, ridding the land of enemies. Joshua is a wonderful, wonderful character. But Joshua made a mistake. You see, they get into the land and they're going around and they're obeying God. They're rooting up. They're casting out these Canaanites, these wicked groups of people. Now, as they're working their way through the land, they get to the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites kind of play a little bit of a switcheroo. They realize Israel's come in. They're overwhelming. They're forced. We don't stand a chance. But what they tell Joshua is they say, hey, we're new. Like this edict that God gave you about the people in the land, that doesn't apply to us because we just got here. And they they dirtied up their clothes. They made it look like they had just traveled some great distance. They completely lie to Joshua. Now, Joshua makes a mistake, for he doesn't consult with the Lord. He doesn't take this to God. He doesn't seek divine guidance. And he enters into an accord with the Gibeonites. Like, oh, well, you're new, we're new, let's get along. And so he provides the Gibeonites protection. They get assimilated into Israel, but they maintain their own ethnic identity. As a result, the Gibeonites were given a specific job. The Gibeonites, their main focus was providing materials for the tabernacle. So to operate the tabernacle there in Shiloh, the center of the worship of God, you needed a lot of resource. You're making offerings and sacrifices. Two big things you needed a constant supply of: wood and water. And it was the Gibeonites for 400 or 500 years at this point that had been in the land. They have a peace agreement with the children of Israel, and they're providing the resources for the tabernacle. Now, at some point during the reign of Saul, and we don't have any mention of this in the chronology or in the storyline, so this is an additional detail. At some point, Saul, for the zeal of Israel, makes the decision that he's going to renege on this accord. He's going to change his mind, and he's going to exterminate the Gibeonites. So there is a slaughter of this group of people in direct defiance. Like, God did not orchestrate this. God did not instruct this. Saul just took it upon himself. Yeah, I know Joshua's had this deal with you guys. I know this deal has been upheld for centuries. Yeah, not anymore. And Saul goes on the offensive. It's just kind of a terrible thing that's happened. And as a result of this great error, this sin on the behalf of King Saul, God is judging the people through this famine. So the decision of the leader would have repercussions on the citizens of the nation. Isn't that the truth? And so the people are experiencing suffering, this famine. David's like, something's odd here. He goes to the Lord. What's the deal? God's like, well, it's because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house and what they did to the Gibeonites. That's why there's famine. Therefore, David, he's got to deal with this now. David said to the Gibeonites, so he calls them in for a powwow. He says, what shall I do for you? And with what shall I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? How can I make it right? I know what Saul did. He's gone. I'm king. I know that you were treated poorly. That did not represent God. It did not represent his intention. We understand this. What can I do as the king of Israel to make atonement? A very fascinating word that's used here, to atone for the sin. So the Gibeonites, they say to David, they say, we will have no silver or gold from Saul or his house. So first and foremost, like, we don't want any money. That's not what we want. Nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us. So no arrests, no executions by you. So David said, well, whatever you say, I will do for you. And so they answered the king, as for the man who consumed us and plotted against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the territories of Israel because of Saul, this is what we're going to ask, let seven men of his descendants be delivered to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Geba of Saul, whom the Lord chose. So what do we want? We want recompense. You're speaking of atonement. This gives us an indication that what Saul had done to the Gibeonites had been brutal, that he had gone and indiscriminately killed husbands and sons and daughters, and he had really wreaked havoc on this minority people group in the nation that they were supposed to be protecting. And so David's like, how can we make this good? And they're like, you know what? We don't want money. We don't want you to arrest anyone. We want an eye for an eye. So what we want, what we're requesting, is we want seven of Saul's descendants. We want you to hand them over, and we're going to execute them. We're going to hang them. And so David said, I will give them. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So it is likely, if we're trying to place this within chronology, that this goes back to when David's heart stirred because of the covenant of the Lord. He wants to bless, honor his accord with Jonathan. So he sends out a search party. Are there any descendants of Jonathan left? They find Mephibosheth. He's crippled in his feet. David brings him into his home. Maybe this happened around the same time because it's David's job to find seven descendants of Saul to hand over for judgment. And so in the course of this, we have the way that this is unfolding is that David is making a search. He's going to hand them over, but he spares Mephibosheth, not because of Mephibosheth, but because of an agreement that David had made with Jonathan. So he honors that. Again, Saul's gotten into trouble because he didn't honor a covenant. And so David's making sure that he follows suit and ensuring a covenant remains in place. So the king took Omri and Mephibosheth, obviously a different Mephibosheth, the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ehi, who she bore to Saul. So Saul had a living girlfriend, a hottie on the side, and he had two sons with Rizpah. So David's like, well, let's grab those two. There's two. And then we're told that he took five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Methlatite, and delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites. They hanged them on the hill before the Lord. So they fell, all seven together. They were put to death in the days of the harvest and the first days in the beginning of the barley harvest. It might have piqued your attention, this mention of five sons of Michal. In the Hebrew language, this is Michal, but we know that Michal, who is David's first wife, was barren, that she had no children of her own. And so it is very likely that what's being described here is that Michal's sister, older sister, who had originally been betrothed to David, she had children, she had sons. She likely dies or passes away because Michal doesn't have any children. She steps in as kind of the caregiver. So what we have here is David takes two of the sons of Rizpah, Saul's sons, and then he goes and he takes five sons away from Michal and he gives them to the Gibeonites. They hang them and murder them. Fun story, right? Let's try to make some sense of it. Because initially, it's a real hard one. Because what? God sanctions it. God's saying, Saul treated the Gibeonites poorly. You need to make atonement for this. David goes, they articulate what atonement would look like, and David follows suit. He goes and he takes seven of these sons. He hands them over knowing that he's handing them over to a death sentence. First and foremost, we do need to establish one idea that dispels, I think, some of the dirty element of the story. There is nowhere in the scripture, in fact, the Bible goes above and beyond to make it clear that children are not responsible for the sins of their parents. I find that to be encouraging, right? Like, you might be a total idiot. And yeah, you'll yield effects on your family, don't get me wrong. However, like over and over and over again, the Bible is clear that the sins of a father, the children don't make atonement for that. Now the flip side to it, children and parents were responsible for their children up to a certain age. And so if you allowed your kid to go and act all wild, you would have to make atonement for that. So parents had a huge responsibility with regards to their children, rightfully so, but children were freed from like that generational sin and consequence, which then makes this passage a little bit more complicated, doesn't it? Because God is directly like approving that very thing, at least as it's initially seen. Saul has treated the Gibeonites very terribly. As a result, seven of his sons are going to pay the penalty. Obviously, that can't be the dynamic because God will never contradict himself. He's very involved. So how do we reconcile this? I want you to go back to verse 1. What had happened? And again, we don't have the story recorded for us, so we have to kind of piece some things together, read a little through the lines. But notice the Lord answered, I'll read it again. Why is the famine? It's because of Saul and, note, his bloodthirsty house. So this is, we have two things. It's not just Saul. Whatever happened with the Gibeonites, whatever the slaughter looked like, yes, Saul no doubt was involved. But it would appear who else was involved? Well, these seven sons of Saul. And God describes them as being bloodthirsty. You can go on your own to Numbers 35, verses 30 and 34, about how murder left undealt with. Murder in the land, not addressed judiciously. Murder allowed to remain unscathed would bring upon the land effects. That's fitting, right? You have these seven sons who have committed a genocide, atrocities regarding the Gibeonites. It's not been dealt with. Likely David doesn't know. As a result, as God had prophesied in Numbers, the land would bear its effects. There's a famine. So David takes these seven men and he gives them over to the Gibeonites, not because they're innocent, but because very likely they were as guilty as Saul and the brutality or the wickedness demonstrated towards the Gibeonites. And so this, again, would reconcile a very complicated passage. The scene, you've got these seven men hung. And we're told, verse 10, that Rizpah, the daughter of Ehi, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until late rains poured on them from heaven. And she did not allow the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor beasts of the field by night. So this poor woman, she's lost her sons, and she's protecting them. She doesn't leave. They've been hung. Their bodies are hanging. They are left susceptible to scavengers and beasts and a measure of desecration. So get the image. This woman's there for weeks wearing sackcloth. She's in mourning, and she's protecting the bodies of her sons. Now, this was told to David, verse 11, what Rizpah, the concubine of Saul, had done. So David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the streets of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hung them up after the Philistines had struck down Saul and Gilboa. If you recall, in the battle where Saul and Jonathan lose their lives, their bodies are taken by the Philistines. They're hung on the wall. They're trophies. And because Saul earlier had been very kind to the men of Jabesh-Gilead early in his reign, these men go in a covert operation and they steal the bodies. So they retrieve the bodies of Saul and Jonathan. It appears it had remained there in Jabesh-Gilead. And so David is going to collect all of this. Verse 13, he brought up the bones of Saul, the bones of Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin. That's where they were from, in Zelah, and the tomb of Kish, Saul's father. So they performed all that the king commanded, and after that, God heeded the prayer for the land. This gives us a measure of, well, the complicated nature of being king. David is dealing with cleanup on Isle Saul. You know, the nation has suffered. There's been famine. He knows why. He's not going to hand over Mephibosheth. He's got an agreement with Jonathan. That's going to hold true. He gives over seven men who were likely wicked. They get what they deserve. This is atonement. This is judgment. Life for life. But you sense David's compassion still here, right? Seeing Rizpah protecting the bodies, he gives the order, take them down. Take the bodies down. Treat them with respect. In fact, let's go ahead and let's get Saul's bones. Let's get Jonathan's bones. Let's take the family to their plot. Let's treat them with dignity. Again, there's an element of David here that needs to be acknowledged, because this is very kind. It's kind because he doesn't have to do jack anything. He doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to. Saul had been his enemy. Saul had caused David to spend years on the run. Saul had put a poison pill in the mind of his first wife, who he loved. David had suffered greatly. And now he's come to the throne, and no one would have blamed David for being like, you know what? The family kind of getting what they deserve. And yet, why does David decide that he's going to treat Saul with kindness? Because I think ultimately David wanted to be treated with kindness himself. Like, I hope you know, I mean, we say this to our kids, let me remind the adults in the room, that, you know, treat people how you want to be treated. It's such a simple thing, right? We teach our kids that basic idea when they're little. Somehow we forget later in life. Treat people the way you want to be treated. We'd really change the way that we behave a lot, wouldn't it? David is dealing kindly. Moving on. When the Philistines were at war, again, with Israel, this very likely you could place somewhere between 2 Samuel chapter 12, 2 Samuel 13. This was when they were doing these battles with the Philistines. David and his servants with him went down and fought against the Philistines. And in the course of the battle, David grew faint. Then Ishbi-benob, why would you name your child that? Ishbi-benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, which is a reference to Goliath, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, who was bearing a new sword, thought he could kill David. So one of the sons of Goliath, in the midst of this battle, he notices that David has grown faint. He's a giant himself, just by the nature of the armor, the weight to carry it and to go into battle with such things. It's actually interesting, the phrase, if you look, who was bearing a new sword? Your translation might have sword and italicized. That's because we're not really sure what word should be translated there. It's likely that this was some type of a new armor, probably lighter. The Philistines were way advanced in the transition from the Bronze to the Iron Age, way more advanced than the Israelites were. So this is a reference. You had Goliath's son. He sees David. He's all geared up with new weaponry. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine and killed him. Abishai is David's nephew. He's brothers with Joab. He, as we'll see, was one of David's mighty men. He sees his king. He's tired. He's vulnerable. He sees a giant approaching. He jumps into the fray. He defends David, and he strikes down the Philistine. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall go out no more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel." David has gotten older in age. They're like, your days of frontline battling are behind you. Now it happened afterwards that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then don't judge. Killed Saph. Why can't they all be four letters? Who was also one of the sons of the giant. Again, there was war at Gob with the Philistines, where Elanan, the son of, again, of the Bethlehemite, killed the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And yet again, verse 20, there was war at Gath. It's a Philistine stronghold. And there was a man of great stature who had six fingers on each hand, six toes on each foot. The dude had digits, 24 in number. I love the Bible. It gives us the most random details. Like, there was another giant. He was a little different than the others. His hand, can you imagine a giant and his hand had six fingers. 24 digits. I mean, it had to have been massive. And it doesn't seem like it was like one of those like weird little jokers that kind of come off the side, you know, deformities. You know, like this is like a full-blown extra finger. I had a friend in Bible college. He had his finger. He was a Ninja Turtle, but his fingers were like this. They were normal. They were just big, big fingers. Like somehow, it was like, I mean, he was set up for Star Trek. You know what I mean? Like, we called him Tripod. That was his nickname. This guy had a bunch of them, a bunch of fingers, a bunch of toes. He was born to a giant. So when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shema, David's brother, killed him. These four were born to the giant Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Yeah, what an interesting little passage about, you know, taking care of the giants. Because if you go back to when they first encountered a giant by the name of Goliath, was anyone really interested in hand-to-hand combat with giants? No, in fact, the armies of Israel were standing, they were cowering in fear. And Goliath would come out every day, and he would mock the God of Israel, and he would mock the Jewish people, and he would demand a warrior as great as he come out, and no one would come out. So Saul even has to sweeten the pot. He's like, I'll give you a woman, I'll give you, you know, a tax write-off, and, you know, and a lot of dough. Like, I'll sweeten till no one wants to go fight giants. Should have been Saul. He was the largest guy in Israel, 7 feet himself, and yet he wouldn't go. Like, no one wanted to fight. And yet what happened? The story. You have this shepherd boy, probably 17 years old. He comes, he's bringing refreshments for his brothers who are there in the camp. He hears the giant mocking God, and young David decides, I'm going to go and do something about this. He goes out and he kills a giant. You know why we have giant killers here? It's because their king was a giant killer. David had gone out, and what happened? David acted in faith. He was bold. And you know, faith and boldness is contagious. Because now we have a list of others who before were towering in fear, but now they're going out and they're slaying giants. Amazing. How contagious faith is. Even if the giant has 6 fingers and 6 toes. Chapter 22. Then David spoke to the Lord the words of this song. On the day when the Lord had delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And he said, pause for a moment. What we have here is fascinating. We actually have a psalm of David. David was the sweet psalmist of Israel. He penned, prolific writer. David expressed himself in poetry, and he put the poetry to music, and we have so many of them recorded for us in the book of Psalms. This is unique because we have here a psalm of David presented for us now in the histories. This is duplicated in the Psalms. This, what we'll find, is Psalms 18. So we have Psalms 18 recorded for us in 2 Samuel 22, meaning we have it twice in the Scriptures. Let me give you a little clue regarding the Bible. Anytime you find stories repeated or things repeated, there's a reason. They're important. They demand your attention. So the fact that we have this psalm in particular recorded for us in two places means that God is letting us know this is an important thing. Now we're given the context here. The context is that David has finished his battles. He's been victorious. Again, the words of the song, when the day God had delivered him from the hand of his enemies and from the hand of Saul, Psalms 18. Also should note, if you do a comparison between the two, there are a few minor edits. Likely, the explanation for this is that David wrote this song. This was a personal journal entry. He wrote it, again, within the context. and his own prayer life. This was between him and God. And then at some point later in life, as they're taking the songs that David had written and they're compiling them into a book of Psalms for the people of Israel, that David probably made a few minor edits, a few adjustments, because he was the author. He could do that. And so that gives us the explanation for some of the differences. One difference that's significant, we're going to hold and get to at the end of our study. But let's work our way through this. David begins, he says, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer." I love that. The Lord, Jehovah, God, is his rock, his foundation, sturdy, immovable, strong. And he's my fortress. It's where I take protection. I find safety in this relationship with the Lord. He's my rock on which I stand. He's my fortress. He surrounds me, and he's my deliverer. The God of my strength, and whom I will trust, my shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior. You save me from violence. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. And note in verse 3, how many times David says, my strength, my shield, my salvation, my stronghold, my refuge, my Savior. This was not a God to David that existed in an ivory tower. This was not a God that was theoretical. This was not the God of someone else. For David, the Lord was his deliverer and his fortress and his rock, and he had a relationship with him. My. You know, you have that same opportunity. Not just to live the faith of your spouse or live the faith of your parents or live the faith of the good old US of A. Like, you can know personally the God of the universe. The God that spoke all things into existence out of nothing. That God, you can know him. And you can have a relationship with him. And it's personal. This was personal for David. Verse 5. When the waves of death surrounded me, the floods of ungodliness made me afraid. The sorrows of Sheol, hell, surrounded me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried out to my God, and he heard my voice from his temple, or literally from heaven, and my cry entered his ears. I love David's honesty, his realness here. Two things that he mentions being afraid. And we don't talk about that really with David. Like, we think of David running out and taking on battles and waging war and having fights. And in this, he's like, hey, sometimes I found myself in hell with an enemy that was facing me. And I was afraid. I was filled with fear. He says, verse 7, in my distress. He acknowledges distress. First, please know, if you have a personal God, you can be personal as well. You can be honest. David is honest with God. There have been times that I was in distress and I was afraid and I felt like I was in hell and I didn't know what to do and I was disoriented. And yet in that scene and in that experience, what did he do? He says he cried out. He called upon the Lord. He cried out to his God. And what happened? Well, it's a saying that can happen for you in your fear. It can happen for you in your distress. God will hear your voice. He hears. I love the line, my cry entered his ears. God hears you. God knows. Don't ever mistake God's silence for his absence. Then the earth shook and trembled. The foundations of heaven quaked because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils, and devouring fire from his mouth. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heaven also and came down with darkness under his feet. He rode upon the cherub and flew, and he was seen upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness canopies around him, dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. From the brightness before him, coals of fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice. He sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning bolts, and he vanquished them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were uncovered at the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of the breath of his nostrils. You know, you're going to be hard-pressed to find this particular scene articulated in any practical experience in David's life. A couple ways that we can view this. Again, David is being poetic. I do think that there's as potentially an eschatological angle to this, and I just used a big word, that David is seeing God's response at the end of time, dealing with the ultimate enemy, dealing with Satan, during the apocalyptic events recorded at the end of Revelation. The language is very similar. But I love the way that David is over the top, and why is he over the top? Again, the flow of it, he's identified what God is to him in his personal relationship. He acknowledges his trial and his struggle and his fear and his distress, and he's articulated himself to God, and he knows that God has heard. And what is he saying? And God acted. And he acts. And when God acts, he'll go above and beyond. He goes big when he acts for his children. God needs to throw lightning bolts down to defend me. He's going to do that. If he needs to cause the earth to quake, he'll do that. You know, as a father, you understand that. Especially a father of children, a father of a daughter. Like if Mabel was in distress and I heard in my ears those cries, I might be prone to overreact. Right? Like, that's just the nature of it. If mine are being threatened, oh, I'm jumping in the fray. I'm going big. And then you find out, you know, it wasn't that big, you know. But I love the poetic angle of David saying, I had fear, I had distress, I cried out to God, and he acted. He acted for me. He sent, verse 17, from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me. For they were too strong for me. They comforted me in the day of my calamity. But the Lord was my support. Literally, the Lord grounded me. He also brought me out into a broad place. He delivered me because he delighted in me. You should highlight those last two lines of verse 20. He delivered me. Why? Because I had proven myself worth. He delivered me because he saw me and thought, man, I can't lose that guy. What would we do without Zach? No, God delivers. Why? God intervenes in your life. Why? God works. Why? Because he delights in you. That's the only reason. Do you know that God delights in you? He delights in you. And he knows everything about you. You know, isn't that the fear? Okay, people like me, but they like me because they don't really know me. And I'm going to play the social game where I'm vulnerable enough, but like I can't let someone really see me as I am because, well, I know what I am and I'm not that likable. I know it. But God knows everything about you. Yeah, those things that you're thinking of right now, even those things, he knows. And guess what? He still delights in you. He still loves you. Verse 21, the Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands. He has recompensed me, for I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God, for all his judgments were before me. And as for his statutes, I did not depart from them. I was also blameless before him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore, the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my uncleanness. Please keep in mind that David is living in the old covenant. This is the old covenant. And guess what? There were laws, there was rules, there was regulation, and you were to obey them. And David's speaking of his own righteousness. And I think this is a good indicator that this psalm had to have been written before some of the stories we've been looking at of David's adultery and his murder and his family dysfunction. It would come a moment where David could never have uttered these words, right? Which is interesting to me in that context, because there is an element of pride here from David. And yet that pride would be stripped away, wouldn't it? For David, at the end of his life, could never dare come before God and utter some of these things. For his statutes, I did not depart from them. I was blameless. I kept myself from iniquity. No, no, and no. With the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. With the blameless man, you will show yourself blameless. With the pure, you will show yourself pure. And with the devious, you will show yourself shrewd. You will save the humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty, that you may bring them down. In Luke chapter 6, Jesus would add to this. He would say, forgive, and you will be forgiven. Again, the idea of like we need to treat others as we want them to treat us. But God will treat us as we treat others. And there's a truth to that. You will save the humble people. Your eyes are on the haughty, that you may bring them down. You know, there's the passage where we're told in the New Testament that God gives grace to the humble, but he resists the proud. Why does God resist the proud? It's not to destroy the proud. It's to bring them to a place of humility. Why? Because that's the prerequisite for grace. You see, God will resist the proud person, not to destroy them, but to humble them, because that's the prerequisite for grace, humility. Not like some self-deprecating, woe is me, I'm so bad. No, humility is an accurate understanding of self. Pride is an inaccurate one. A proud person, everyone looks at it and they're like, man, they don't really know who they are. A humble person knows. And it's that knowledge of like, I'm an idiot. And God's like, yes, here's some grace. For you are my lamp, O Lord. The Lord shall enlighten my darkness. For by you I can run against a troop. By my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is proven. He is a shield to all who trust him. That's a tough one, man. As for God, his way is perfect. Does it feel that way all the time? It's like, man, for God, I could give you a lot of advice on how to make my life better. But his way is perfect. It might not be what you agree with, or what you would have drawn up, or what you would have determined for yourself. But if God is sovereign and he's good and he loves you, then his way, while it might not be yours, is perfect. For who is God except the Lord? There is no other God. And who is a rock except our God? God is my strength and power. He makes my way perfect. He's getting back to the mys. He makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He sets me on a high place. He teaches my hands to make war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have also given me the shield of your salvation. Your gentleness has made me great. You enlarged my path under me, so my feet did not slip. I have pursued my enemies and destroyed them. Neither did I turn back again till they were destroyed. And I have destroyed them and wounded them so that they could not rise. They have fallen under my feet, for you have armed me with strength for the battle. For you, David acknowledges his role in the victories, but then he comes quickly back to, but it's you. For you, you have acted, you have armed me with strength for battle. You have subdued me under those who rose against me. You have also given me the necks of my enemies so that I destroy those who hated me. They looked, but there was none to save, even to the Lord. But he did not answer them. Then I beat them as fine as the dust of the earth. I trod them like dirt in the streets, and I spread them out. I was victorious. You have delivered me from the strivings of my people. You have kept me as the head of the nations. A people I have not known shall serve me, and foreigners submit to me. His kingship, his rule, his reign. As soon as they hear, they obey me. The foreigners fade away. They come frightened from their hideouts. Let's finish it up. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. He comes back to verse 2. Let God be exalted, the rock of my salvation. It is God who avenges me and subdues the people under me. He delivers me from my enemies. You also lift me up above those who rise against me. You have delivered me from the violent man. Therefore, as a result of all the things you've done, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles, and sing praises to your name. The motivation for our worship is God's goodness. He is the tower of salvation to his king and shows mercy to his anointed, to David and his descendants forevermore. Let's go back to the way it begins. You'll note, verse 2, the psalm begins, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer." Now, within the context here, we've acknowledged that David is writing this earlier in life. And because of a more context of just this personal righteousness, he's done this before his sin with Bathsheba, before his great fall, before all of the stuff his sin yielded. So this was written early. Now, we acknowledge that we get Psalm 18, for David would have edited it and then submitted it. Flip to Psalm 18. You will notice at the very beginning of Psalm 18 that he begins the song with a different line. Like the most obvious editorial addition yielded to the transition of passages here is the inclusion of verse 1. Verse 1 is not in the original. It's added later. And what do we read? David begins the song. He doesn't begin, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress." No, he begins, "I will love you, O Lord, my strength." He begins, "I will love you." At no point in the previous rendition of the song is there this acknowledgement of love. There is absolutely the relationship back and forth between God, deliverer, salvation, strength, rock, fortress. We get all these terminologies. And then yet David lives some life. And David sinned in great ways. David experienced great punishment, judgment, consequence. And he goes to take this song. He's like, "Hey, this is a good one. I'll submit this to the scribes. It can be included in the annals. But you know what? I got to make an addition. After I have lived this life, after I've made terrible mistakes, after I have experienced the overwhelming, powerful, unchanging love of God and grace of God, for I was not worthy of any of it, I will begin, I will love you, O Lord, my strength." This word love is only used here by a human being. This word in the Hebrew is used frequently but it's always used to describe God's love for us. And yet David, at the end, he cries out to God, I don't love you in the context of how I love my children. I don't love you in the context of how I love my wife, my spouse, friends. God, I love you. I will love you for all of my life. I will try to love you the way you love me. David experienced the love of God. How? By making terrible decisions, experiencing brutal consequence, repenting, owning it, never running, but grace. David experienced God's grace and failure. And so when he goes to submit, he's like, I have to make a change. I can't begin, the Lord is my rock. I must begin, I will love you, O Lord, my strength. Do you love God? We're told that we love him. Why? Or how? For he first loved us. The massive, incredible amount of sacrificial God love for you. A love so great, he sent his only begotten son to die so that you might have everlasting life. A love. Jesus would say there's no greater love than to lay down one's life for a friend. And that was the precursor to his own actions. There's no greater love of God than for God to have laid down himself for us. And it's that love, friend, that does change it all. It's a love that I can't earn. It's a love I definitely don't deserve, but it's a love I get to enjoy. For he loves me, and he delights in me, and he knows me. For while I was still yet a sinner, Christ died for me and for you. David's failure had brought him to a greater realization of the depths of God's love. And if you find yourself this morning in a place of failure, if you look at yourself and you see someone totally unlovable, you might be right to everyone but God. For he loves you. And he has a plan and he wants to work. And you don't have to run. I will love you, O Lord, my strength. So, Father, Lord, we say thank you for that incredible love.